This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with human rights attorney Reed Brody, who's just written a wonderful book called To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hossein Habré.
It's an example of how determined lawyers and courageous victims can fight back and win.
Attorney Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation talks about the Supreme Court's recent decision involving freedom of religion.
Unless you separate church and state, you're going to get what Jefferson called torrents of blood. The wall between church and state has been torn down by these reactionary judges on the Supreme Court.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Human rights attorney Reed Brody's page-turning book, To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hossein Habré, is being published this month, November 2022, by Columbia University Press. Habré was the dictator of Chad, a landlocked country in Central Africa, from 1982 to 1990. He was deposed by a coup and exiled to nearby Senegal. Attorney Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch led a coalition of human rights activists, lawyers, and victims, which brought Habré to justice. The lead attorney lawyer for the victims was African attorney Jacqueline Mudina. Habré was found guilty in a courtroom in Dakar, Senegal, in May of 2016, of rape, sexual slavery, torture, and the killing of over 40,000 citizens of Chad. He was the first former head of state to be convicted of crimes against humanity in the courts of another country. We speak today with Reed Brody, who worked for 18 years with Human Rights Watch alongside Hossein Habré's victims. Reed Brody has helped pursue dictators Augusto Pinochet of Chile, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier of Haiti, and Yahya Jammeh of Ghana. He also uncovered atrocities of U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua, led U.N. missions in El Salvador, in the Congo, and exposed the Bush administration's torture. Attorney Reed Brody, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Reed, who is the dictator we're talking about, Hossein Habré? What did he do, and why do you call him the African Pinochet?
So Hossein Habré was the dictator of Chad from 1982 to 1990. He was put into power, as we'll certainly talk about, by Ronald Reagan in the first covert operation of the Ronald Reagan period, before the Jonas Savimbi in Angola, before the Contras in Nicaragua. And he's accused, in fact, since been convicted, of thousands of political killings, of systematic torture between 1982 and 1990. I call him the African Pinochet because at the time that we began the case, Augusto Pinochet had been arrested in London on a warrant from a Spanish judge. That was the beginning of really the era of universal jurisdiction and international justice. And we want, I think both Pinochet and Hossein Habré would be very insulted to be compared to each other, very different people. Pinochet, a Catholic, strong defender of religion and conservatism. Hossein Habré, actually, background as a desert warlord spouting Mao and Che Guevara. Hossein Habré was living in exile in Senegal. And when I was working on the Pinochet case in London with Michael Ratner and many others, and when the House of Lords said that Augusto Pinochet could be arrested anywhere in the world, despite his status as a former head of state, we realized that we had a new tool to bring to justice people who seemed out of the reach of justice. And we were approached by Chadians who said, well, we have somebody who did worse things than Pinochet, and he's now living in Senegal. And so when we brought the case against Habré, we wanted to really emphasize that we were kind of pulling a Pinochet. We were doing the same thing. We were using the principle of universal jurisdiction. Just the way Pinochet from Chile could be arrested in London, Hissin Habre of Chad could be arrested in Senegal, and that is what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reed, you know, it took you and your team 18 years, heroic 18 years, I would add, to bring this monster really to justice. Why did it take so long?
Well, it at first it looked like it was going to go very well. We put together teams in both Chad and Senegal. We sent investigators to Chad to work with the victims, to prepare a dossier. And in this really a surprise operation, we brought the Chadians to Senegal, the victims, and we filed the case before an investigating judge. And within a couple of weeks, the investigating judge had arrested Hissin Habre and put him under house arrest and indicted him on torture charges. And it seemed like it was going to go well. And then really politics entered the picture. We had timed the complaint for electoral season because we figured this would be the president of Chad at the time would not want to be seen defending a dictator. But the new president who came in really put the kibosh on everything. And he brought in Habre's lawyer as his main legal advisor, and he basically had the case thrown out. It took us another 15 years to get back to court. We filed the case first in Belgium under Belgium's long-arm universal jurisdiction law. A Belgian judge began to investigate the case, spent 4 years, in fact, went to Chad, conducted a mission, prepared the case. But as you may remember, the Belgian law on universal jurisdiction, which at the time, together with the Spanish law, was the widest in the world, it was great when it was being used against people from Rwanda or others. But when there were cases filed in Belgium, first against Ariel Sharon of Israel, and then against George Bush's father for alleged war crimes in the first Gulf War, Donald Rumsfeld, the then Secretary, U.S. Secretary of Defense, came to Belgium. I was there. And he said, if NATO leaders cannot come to Belgium without fear of being arrested, then maybe we'll have to move NATO out of Belgium. And the law collapsed like a house of cards. But then, as the law was collapsing, we brought the Chadian victims. We brought victims from around the world to Belgium to plead their case. And this is, to me, one of the great lessons of the Habre case, was how victims are their own best advocates. Because the hero of this story, who maybe we'll talk about, Suleiman Genge, who was a prisoner of Habre's and came out and began the fight for justice, he went to Belgium and he looked the politicians in the eye. We met the Minister of Justice, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And he said, you know, I came out of jail. I promised, as people were dying around me, that I was going to fight for justice if I ever got out. We went to Senegal. Senegal betrayed us. We came to Belgium. We felt that you had sent us a lifeline. You sent us a judge. You began investigating the case. We really believed in you. And now you're telling me because of Donald Rumsfeld, I can't get justice? And the Belgian, no, Mr. Gengeng, no, Mr. Gengeng, we'll figure out a way. And so actually, as the law, Belgian law was collapsed under the weight of double standards and Donald Rumsfeld, a grandfather clause was put in to save our case. And Belgium continued, indicted Hissin Habre, requested Habre's extradition from Senegal. Senegal then hemmed and hawed, referred the case to the African Union. The African Union sent the case back, said, Senegal, you have to prosecute. Senegal said, we will, but then they didn't. And then we got Belgium. Because of the work that Suleiman had done in Belgium, we created a real reservoir of support. And Belgium took the case. They took Senegal to the International Court of Justice. And in a 15-0 decision, the International Court of Justice said to Senegal, you have to prosecute Hissin Habre without further delay or extradite him. And then by that time, a new president was in power in Senegal, actually just a month before that decision, a president who Suleiman and the other victims and I had met and who promised to do justice. And within 2 years, the court was set up and Hissin Habre was on trial. But it took a very long time.
Just to be clear here, Reed, can you explain in a couple of sentences just what the principle of universal jurisdiction is?
So universal jurisdiction is the principle of international law that some crimes are so heinous that the courts of any country can prosecute those crimes sort of as a court standing in for humanity. And that was the principle under which Adolf Eichmann was tried in Israel, although his crimes predated even the existence of the State of Israel. It was the principle that was used to prosecute pirates in the old days and then torturers. And it's really, it's international law's answer to the spectacle of tyrants and torturers who cover themselves with immunity at home. And it prevents them from getting a safe haven in another country. And now, actually, there are many trials. There was recently, last week, a trial in France of a Liberian warlord. We saw who was in France and was convicted. We saw a few months ago Syrian intelligence agents who were prosecuted and convicted in Germany. So it's a principle of international law that is being used more and more in our globalized world. Habre is the only case ever of a head of state being prosecuted under the principle of universal jurisdiction.
I wonder, Reed, is there perhaps a favorite, or short, given our time constraints, part of your book which you would care to read for our listeners?
You know, I'll go with actually the very opening of the book, which is in Chad under Habre in 1989. And the book begins, "Kamatu." Abu Musa, the prison warden, was yelling into the cell in Chadian Arabic as he did each morning. "How many are dead?" "Three," one of the prisoners answered feebly. "Not yet," replied Musa. "I'll take away the corpses when there are five." Suleiman Gengeng, lying in the cell in the prison at the gendarmerie of the Chadian capital, had seen dozens of other prisoners die already, and he feared he might be next. He had contracted dengue fever and malaria and could hardly stand. Their large cell here was almost completely sealed off, with no natural light coming in and temperatures routinely reaching 110 degrees. The stench of human waste and decomposing bodies was unbearable. To keep his mind alive, he murmured Christian songs to himself. "I am not afraid. God is with me. A divine promise supports my faith." And then I end the chapter by saying, Suleiman endured, but he also took an oath before God that if he ever got out of prison alive, that he would spend the rest of his days fighting to bring his oppressors to justice.
Reed Brody, you're an international law attorney. Jim Lafferty and I are both attorneys. We're here at Law and Disorder. We wanted to ask you, Reed, the International Criminal Court has been set up, but has only secured three final convictions, and those have been of rebel warlords, not heads of state. It's spent $1.7 billion in the past. How does that compare to the court that was set up and successfully handled the Havre case, the Extraordinary African Chambers?
Well, that's a great question. You're absolutely right. In 20 years, the ICC has only convicted rebels. Not one state official at any level anywhere in the world. At the same time, I think the existence of the ICC has been incredibly important, both because of the norms that it sets forth, many of which have been transposed into international law, because it represents a global commitment, uneven, of course, to the idea of fighting impunity, and also because it sits as a weight on a lot of the ICC is on the tail of a lot of countries pushing them. And we have seen in the last 20 years a huge amount of justice around the world. We've seen heads of state in countries, but this has all been done at the national and what the so-called hybrid level. So you've seen in Latin America, Fujimori prosecuted for human rights crimes in Peru, Rios Montt for genocide in Guatemala, Charles Taylor by the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Even in the Habre case, I don't think we would have been able to do it without the ICC. Why? Because the African Union wanted to get the ICC off its backs. The first 29 indictments from the ICC were of Africans, and the African Union wanted to show to the ICC that it could prosecute its own people. And so, as I told earlier, the African Union sent the case back to Senegal and ultimately formed a hybrid court with Senegal, a court that was invested with the authority both of Senegal and the African Union, that had judges mostly from Senegal but also from the African Union. It only cost $10 million, a lot of money to you and me, but compared to the billion, to the $2 billion at the ICC or the $1 billion at the war crimes tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, just really a drop in the bucket. A lot of that, of course, is because the victims over 20 years, over the 16 years that we were preparing the trial, we also prepared evidence. We found thousands of documents of Habre's political police with Habre's handwriting on it, lists of people who died in jail. We really were able to hand the case to the court effectively on a silver platter.
Reed, thank you for that. But you know, Reed, also, it seems that it's a fair criticism, really, to say that the only people that are brought to justice are from, well, weak non-Western countries. It seems almost impossible to bring war criminals like Henry Kissinger or Donald Rumsfeld or George Bush to justice. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think that's an absolutely fair criticism. I mean, as Michael Smith knows, Michael Ratner and I tried to bring Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush to book. We filed cases in France, in Germany, in Spain. Each time, politics trumped the law. I mean, I think we're seeing even in Ukraine. I don't think, you know, I mean, there's been a vast mobilization, maybe we'll talk about that, around crimes in Ukraine. But, you know, the international justice system does not have a police force. The United States has refused to join the ICC. The United States is very happy and has been very constructive in the Habre case and in many others for justice for others. But there are zones of impunity. The countries on the Security Council, China, Russia, the United States, countries that they protect, Israel, Syria, North Korea. It's very difficult to, as you say, there's been very little or no justice against powerful actors. And I think that's a major flaw, obviously, in not just, it's not so much in the international justice system, in the international political system.
We're talking with human rights attorney Reed Brody. Columbia University Press has just published his wonderful book, To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissène Habre. Why do you write that the United States and France played a pivotal role in supporting Habre?
So, you know, the Chad, I mean, you have to see where Chad is. It's in a very, what they call a very dangerous neighborhood. It's between Libya and Sudan and Central African Republic. And at the time when Ronald Reagan took power, Libya was, in fact, Libya of Muammar Gaddafi fame, was actually occupying the north of Chad. And Reagan called Gaddafi the mad dog of the Middle East, and he was determined to stop Gaddafi. And the U.S. identified Libyan troops in Chad as a vulnerability. And Alexander Haig, according to Bob Woodward, he said, we're going to use Hissin Habre to bloody Gaddafi's nose. And the U.S., at the time, Hissin Habre was a desert warlord. He became prime minister. He then broke with the president. A huge civil war broke out in which Habre's troops were committed massive atrocities. This is before he became president. But the U.S. did not care. They saw him as the anti-Gaddafi. And so the U.S., first covert operation, brings Hissin Habre into power. Then France is kind of brought along. Then France in particular, but also the U.S., then support him in a war in which he defeats Gaddafi. And when he defeats Gaddafi, he gets a state invitation to the White House. As you said, he's received with honors. He was also a special guest at the July 14th celebration in France. He was the toast of the town. As the U.S. ambassador said, he came to America and he had delivered Gaddafi's head on a silver platter. 20 years later, we get Habre convicted. And the U.S. supported, you know, I have to say, under the Obama administration, the U.S. supported us. And we got support from, despite the fact that, you know, this would bring up, you know, U.S. crimes of the past. John Kerry made a statement that this conviction would be a good opportunity to reflect on, you know, the U.S.'s role in bringing in Habre's era. Obviously, the U.S. has not done so. Right as we speak, there's another dictator in Chad, not as bloody as Hissin Habre, but 50 people were killed the other day and demonstrations were gunned down. And the U.S. still supports the Chadian government as an island of stability, this time against jihadists who have taken over much of the region.
Now, Reed Brody, you dedicate your fine book to Michael Ratner and to your son, Zach, and Habre's victims. Your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, Michael was my hero, my mentor, my co-teacher, my friend. And throughout the book, I mean, the book is a very action-oriented, character-driven, kind of tries to be a thriller. But the moments of reflection in the book are moments where I'm talking to Michael. Michael had did not believe particularly in the law. Michael believed that, you use the law, you use courts to expose in American policy, to expose oppression. I was always kind of laser focused on the bottom line, are we going to win? And that, for Michael, was not the issue. And so we go back and forth. I mean, I learned a lot from Mike. Every time we talk, as we did today, about Hissin Habre, I make sure to talk about how he was put in power by the U.S., how he was supported by the West, how double standards operate, how it's great to get justice for an African dictator, but you need to look at the larger questions.
Reed, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. Can you tell us briefly what you're working on now and how people can follow your work?
So now I work as an independent war crimes prosecutor, helping others who are looking to do this. And I'm particularly working these days with the victims of the former president of Gambia, Yahya Jammeh, who's in exile in Equatorial Guinea. I work closely with the Bar Association with Gambian victims. People can follow my work on Twitter, maybe not so much longer, in the news, I guess.
Let's just mention your book again, Reed, To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissin Habre, a great book, a real page-turner. I read it. It was a thriller. Thank you, Reed. Thank you for your good work. Thank you for your book. And thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
I was very happy to be on this show. I love your show. Take care, guys.
We'll see you at the book launch, Reed. Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Hardening crimes is a part of the times, and it's rough for some people to live. Disease can move fast, but it don't have to last. It is now the nation's turn.
The United States Supreme Court made a 5-4 decision in the case of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn and Agudath Israel of America versus Governor Mario Cuomo, which reversed a precedent and crashed through the wall separating church and state. The men who wrote the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which separated church and state, were mostly not Christians. America was not created as a Christian country. This is a myth. Nor was it founded on Judeo-Christian principles. This is another myth. The founding fathers were deists. They were products of the Enlightenment. They did not believe in a God that played any role in human affairs. They understood from European history the terrible consequences of not separating church and state. Today's Christian nationalists and evangelicals, mostly Trump supporters, are relentless in their attempts to tear down the wall of separation. These people have substantial political power. They are much of Trump's base. They succeeded in getting Amy Coney Barrett appointed to the Supreme Court. 2 weeks ago, she, along with four reactionary Catholic judges, Alito, Kavanaugh, Thomas, and Gorsuch, prevented Governor Cuomo and his scientific advisors from limiting the number of people who attend Roman Catholic and ultra-Orthodox Jewish services in Brooklyn. This decision will cost lives in New York and nationally as it ties the hands of governments trying to limit the human toll of the COVID-19 pandemic. Today we speak with attorney Andrew Seidel, a constitutional litigator with the Freedom from Religion Foundation and the author of The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. Andrew Seidel, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Andrew, let's talk about the recent case called the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Brooklyn and Agudath Israel of America against Governor Andrew Cuomo. What are the salient facts in that?
Essentially, this is a challenge against Governor Cuomo's public health orders, trying to stop the spread of a lethal virus that has killed more than 250,000 Americans. The goal is obviously to stop the spread, protect public health, protect people, while giving them as much freedom as possible to continue to live their lives. And the Catholic Diocese, and then this Orthodox Jewish group challenged the order, claiming that it was religious discrimination, and it absolutely was not.
What are the relevant issues that this case raised in the Supreme Court?
Well, one thing that I think everybody needs to understand is, first, the case never should have been decided. The public health orders that the court blocked didn't even apply to the Catholic and Orthodox Jewish groups that were bringing the case. The orders had been changed by the time they got to the court. So, put another way, the case was moot or they had no standing to litigate it. Chief Justice Roberts said that it makes no sense for the court to order the governor not to do what he's not doing. Now, if you listen to conservative media or some of the conservative justices, right, they treated this as like a conspiracy theory to prevent the court from deciding the case, but it wasn't. These orders were meant to be responsive, to be nimble, to constantly be updated with the latest data on the spread of the disease. And again, the goal is to keep people safe while giving them and businesses and the community as much normalcy as possible. And so the case never should have been decided. It's kind of one of the big things that I think most people don't realize, and is, as a lawyer doing this kind of work, is really mind-blowing to see the court go out of its way to then decide this on an emergency basis, especially.
So how did the various justices come out in this case?
Great question. The order was unsigned. It's a per curiam opinion, which means we don't know who wrote it. Normally, justices sign their names. We do know that the five ultra-conservative justices, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, those last three all being Trump appointees, decided in favor of the churches. Justice Roberts, along with the three liberals, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, would have not decided the case or decided against the churches. There are a few different opinions that were signed. So Justice Gorsuch wrote a concurrence that was signed. So did Justice Kavanaugh. And the conventional wisdom at the moment seems to be that Amy Coney Barrett probably is the one who wrote this opinion. And it really is important to know that without Barrett, this case would have gone the other way, for sure. Roberts would likely not have weighed in on the merits of the order. So it would have stood either as a 5-4 the other way, possibly a 4-4-1. So Barrett is not only the reason that the case swung this way, but she's also the person who most people think wrote the opinion, in part because of how poorly it's written and the inexperience that it seems to show.
What was the reasoning that Barrett or whoever wrote it, what, how can they possibly rationally come to the conclusion that they came to?
Well, this is going to take a little while to explain because it doesn't make sense. I think you're having a hard time understanding it because it really doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense. What the court did was weaponize religious freedom. So religious freedom has always been this personal protection that allows believers to believe whatever they want and act on that belief, to worship as they want, so long as they don't harm or injure others or violate somebody else's rights. And that's what this ultra-conservative Christian nationalist bloc on the court is changing. So that short unsigned opinion essentially stated that church's right to religious freedom includes the right to risk the health, safety, and lives of everyone else in the community. So the justices took this hallowed constitutional protection and made it into a tool to afflict and wound. They basically took a plowshare and beat it into a sword. And the way they did that was by crying religious discrimination. And that was essentially the hook that they hung the hat of their opinion on, right? Religious discrimination. That is what it boiled down to. The problem with that is that there was no discrimination. The churches were actually treated more favorably under these orders than other organizations and entities that they were nearly identical to.
Andrew, we've got to ask, what did you think when Justice Gorsuch wrote that it wasn't fair to limit visitors to the Catholic Church or Orthodox synagogues in as much as they weren't limiting visitors to liquor stores?
Yeah, I thought this was just such bad reasoning and so recklessly and deliberately blind. The five that signed on to the majority with Gorsuch, that, you know, they complained variously about hardware stores and acupuncturists, I guess is what you would call them, liquor stores, bike repair shops, accountants, lawyers, insurance agents, right? All of those were open with fewer capacity restrictions than churches. But again, religious worship is different than those one-on-one businesses or stores, right? People gather in large numbers, indoors, close together. They file in and out at the same time in big crowds. They sing, they pray, they chant when they go to church. And all of that helps spread the virus. We know that churches help spread the virus. There's a case study out of Ohio where one worshiper infected nearly 100 other people, half of whom never even stepped foot into the church. Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio said that it spread like wildfire. And this was in August, before things got really bad. So churches are different than liquor stores or bike repair shops or even that one-on-one acupuncture appointment. They are much more like going to a movie or taking in a play or listening to a lecture or watching an indoor sporting event. And this is the key point. All of those were banned under the New York orders that the churches were complaining about. Churches, however, were still allowed to meet, either 10 or less or 25 or less, depending on which zone they were in at the time. So when you compare apples to apples, churches were actually favored under the stay-at-home orders. They were given special privileges, but that wasn't enough. So instead they cried discrimination because they weren't given the most favorable treatment out there. And again, that decision was made to protect public health, to save lives, and not on the basis of religion. It was on the basis of characteristics that relate to the spread of a lethal virus. But you still had 5 of the 6 members on the court's conservative bloc agree that this was discrimination, which is really just mind-blowing and a deeply alarming signal for what is to come.
Yeah, I'll say. Amy Comey Barrett is a member of an evangelical Christian sect that supports Trump. He obliged them and picked her in an attempt to stabilize his eroding support among white evangelicals. He handed over the selection of the nominee to the court to a small group of evangelical leaders. My question, Andrew, is it unconstitutional to pick someone for public office because of their religion?
That's a really good question, and it's something that we've seen come up quite a bit in the wake of the Barrett nomination. So the relevant clause of the Constitution is Article 6, Clause 3, which bans religious tests for public office. And that is a very strong provision of the U.S. Constitution, very concrete. No religious test shall ever be required of any public office or trust under the United States. No, shall, ever, any. These are strong, clear mandate. In a document that's full of a lot of waffling, deliberately sort of nebulous language, you had this one clear statement. And one of the reasons I love it is that this is something that was truly original and unique about the U.S. Constitution. We were the first country to ban religious tests for public office and first written constitution to do that, something that we ought to be very, very proud of, in my opinion. But there's a debate going on about whether or not the language prohibits a president or another elected official from choosing people based on their religion as a sort of characteristic that would allow them to do their job well. And this goes to a big problem that we saw during Amy Coney Barrett's nomination. When she was nominated for the Seventh Circuit, Dianne Feinstein famously said that the dogma lives loudly within her, and that comment blew up in the media, and people said that that was a religious test for public office. So a lot of people who say that it was a violation of Amy Coney Barrett's freedom to ask her about her religion then turn around and say her religion is the reason that we need to put her in office in the first place. So there's a lot of bad conversation going around this. And I've written a number of pieces for Religion Dispatches and Rewire News Service elsewhere talking about what the religious test means and why it's important and okay, for instance, for senators to question judicial candidates about whether or not they will honor the oath of office that they have to take, which is also in Article 6, or whether they're going to hold the Bible or their holy book above that oath of office. And it's deeply problematic. But to answer your question more directly, it's unclear. There's no law directly on point.
Andrew, please talk about any recent important church-state separation cases.
And this is a huge one. This really is a big one, even though it was a emergency case. I mean, what the court said was, if you don't give churches the most favorable treatment possible under the law, we're going to block whatever you're trying to do. Anything less is unconstitutional. In other words, the right to religious freedom is now tops in this brand new hierarchy of rights. And I think we're going to see some other rights tossed in there by this conservative bloc. The Second Amendment rights will probably get elevated in the hierarchy, while reproductive rights, including possibly the right to contraception, will be downgraded, along with another haunting possibility, equal marriage. Again, all this goes back to Amy Coney Barrett. There has been an attempt over the last really 5 years, but you can trace it back even farther, again, to weaponize religious freedom. And that is really what they are doing in this case, to turn that hallowed protection into a tool, a weapon to impose that religion on others. And we are seeing it more and more in the cases. There was an Espinoza versus Montana case that came out of Montana that the Supreme Court decided last term, which essentially said that Christian parents that want to send their kids to private religious school have a right to access taxpayer funds to pay for that religious schooling. That has always been held to be a violation of religious freedom, and that was flipped on its head. The court upheld a 40-foot-tall Christian cross on government property that was, you know, we're paying $200,000 to maintain. They said that that was perfectly fine. It would have been a violation of religious freedom to take it down, even though the Constitution demands it. And there's a very scary case out of Philadelphia this term that the court is going to hear argument on called Fulton versus Philadelphia. And we're expecting a decision probably in the spring, possibly early summer. And that could say that your religion is a right to discriminate against LGBTQ people. And the problem with that is that once you grant a license to discriminate in the name of God, there's no place to draw that line. If you can discriminate, you can discriminate against anybody for any reason, on the basis of race or on the basis of sex. So I'm deeply worried about where this court is going. This decision is a very, very bad omen.
Yeah, well, the Hobby Lobby case before Amy Coney Barrett came on the course scared us all because it gave a religious cover for people who wanted to deny birth control to their employees. But Andrew Seidel, I wanted to ask you if you could do this in a nutshell, which is a tall order, but in a nutshell, what's the history that disposed the founding fathers to make a separation between church and state? It came out of European history, principally in England. In a nutshell, can you tell us what was going on there and why they thought they had to put that provision into the First Amendment?
Torrents of blood. That's what James Madison said. And I write about this a lot in The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. The founders surveyed the history of religion and government, actually both in the old world and incidentally in the new, especially looking at the Puritans and Pilgrims in Massachusetts. And they decided to eschew and reject theocracy and intolerance and condemn those torrents of blood spilled in the name of religion. You know, Jefferson looked back at the millions of innocent men, women, and children who had been burnt, tortured, fined, imprisoned, and yet we have not advanced one inch towards uniformity in Christianity. So the founders really rejected unifying state and church and mandated that separation because of the torrents of blood that had been spilled throughout history. And we are now victims of our own success. You know, state-church separation has been so successful in this country that we are now seeing the Supreme Court of the United States rejecting it as a principle because they don't grasp how dangerous it is to let them be unified.
Andrew, Michael and I were surprised to learn that religious organizations received up to $10 billion in the first round of COVID-19 aid. And that includes the U.S. Catholic Church getting $1.4 billion and possibly up to $3.5 billion. What do you make of this?
And this was something that the Freedom From Religion Foundation was yelling about. You know, we were the voice in the wilderness yelling about how big a problem this was. We actually published some secretive White House calls that showed that the Trump administration and White House was funneling money to Trump's closest supporters, preachers. We were deeply, deeply concerned about this from the beginning. It is absolutely a violation of every American's religious freedom for the government to tax citizens use that coercive taxing power, take money out of your pocket, and then turn around and give it to a church that you do not belong to, a church that condemns you to hell if you don't believe in their particular God. This is why that Montana decision that I mentioned the Supreme Court got wrong earlier, why they got it wrong. So this is a deeply, deeply alarming decision. There was no appetite in Congress to challenge it in any way. There was no good vehicle to challenge it in court in any way. And then the court decided that Montana case and essentially waved off any possible challenge. We are still at the Freedom From Religion Foundation digging into all of the different violations that arose out of this PPP program. Because it's not just the giving money directly to churches. Some of those churches were able to double and triple dip, right? So the Catholic Church that you mentioned, the Catholic Church at the local level might have gotten a PPP fund. Then the diocese might have gotten it. Then the archdiocese might have gotten it. And that's because the Small Business Administration suspended the rules that would normally prevent that from happening as it applied to churches. Just one of the many instances of favoritism that we saw towards religion in the program when religion should have been excluded altogether because of the Constitution, because of the separation of state and church. So this is deeply, deeply worrisome and something we're going to be picking apart, I think, for years to come.
We've been speaking with Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a terrific organization. Andrew, can you tell us in a nutshell what you're working on now and how people can follow your work and the work of the Freedom From Religion Foundation?
I hope everybody goes and joins FFRF. We are at FFRF.org. I am on all the social media places, Andrew L. Seidel, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and I've got my book, The Founding Myth, out, and I'm just starting to write my second book, which is titled Weaponizing Religious Freedom, so keep an eye out for that.
Heidi and I are grateful for your good work, Andrew, and we'll have you back on when the second book comes out, or maybe even before, and maybe even hopefully to talk about a victory.
I would absolutely love that on all fronts.
Andrew, thank you so much, and really great respect for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Heidi. It's always a pleasure.
Last month, several Los Angeles City Council members were caught making racist remarks about black and brown people. To demonstrate the depths of racism in American society, this city council politicians, including one union head, were themselves people of color. Our Law and Disorder radio friend, Raymond Nat Turner, known as the People's Poet for his political activity at Los Angeles City College during the 60s radicalization, wrote the following about this incident. Raymond Nat Turner is a former forklift driver, warehouse worker, janitor. He lives in New York City, where he is a Black Agenda Report poet in residence and co-founder, co-leader of the Resistance and co-founder, co-leader of the jazz poetry ensemble Upsurge New York City.
We were L.A. way before they. Quote, ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have. Unquote. James Baldwin. Venom-drenched recorded conversation of Rattler City Council criminals with labor serpent fluent in forked tongue poisoned the smog city of angels ruled by devils. Not our Chicano moratorium mecha memories of the way we were. Could it be that class struggle was so simple then? We were black and brown poets named Miles, Miguel, Alejandro, Raymond, named Guzman, Proctor, Mugia, Turner, burnished by the breakaway sun and singing songs of solidarity. We were black and brown poets walking vertically, wearing oneness on our sleeves, standing shoulder to shoulder in struggle, filling Compton and LA libraries and stages with four-alarm fire. We were LA. way before they. We were black and brown poets carrying compasses. Southeast L.A., we celebrated piping hot pinto beans, juicy collard greens, handmade tortillas, buttery cornbread, jazz, wine, weed, and mariachi. We celebrated boycotted grapes, brazen black cats, brown berets, and commemorated martyrs. We were L.A. way before they. We were black and brown poets, Sankofa birds flocking, flying forward faster, resisting Pentagon with the wind. Sausage machine in Southeast Asia gobbling up, grinding down steel squads of ghetto barrio warriors suited for service on the home front. We were red car babies with complicated handshakes and embraces, way before black faces in high places, way before brown faces in high places that white supremacy places, making salt of the earth expendable. We were L.A. way before they. We were black and brown poets before cesspool plotters, planners backed by bloody badged bandito executioner muscle, arresting dreams in tarp, tent, cardboard mattress, skid rows. Before Huxtables looking down Pinocchio noses at calloused hands, blistered feet of lunch bucket brigades. Before battery-operated, self-serving, corporate-controlled ethnic cleansers, treacherous white supremacist strongmen, women with worldwide networks. Yes, we were L.A. way before they. We were L.A. way before they.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.